You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. As well, you can hear these podcasts at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. There are two publishing houses, SteinerBooks.org in America and RudolfSteinerPress.com in England, which are the sole publishers of Steiner into English and have given me permission to do these recordings. Please consider patronizing them as well. This is a reading of Collected Works, Volume 75 by Rudolf Steiner, entitled Anthroposophy and the Natural Sciences, translated by Sabine Seiler. This is Lecture 3, entitled Anthroposophy, Its Essence and Its Philosophical Foundations, given in Bern on July 8, 1920. Ladies and gentlemen, the Free Student Association of Bern has invited me to talk to you today about the nature and task of the anthroposophically oriented worldview. And in a few introductory words, I want to point out above all that the anthroposophically oriented worldview wants to be fully in harmony, first, with the most essential cultural demands of the present time, and insofar as we can know these, those of the near future. Second, in particular, this worldview wants to be in full harmony with what has come about in the past three or four centuries for the development of humanity, through what is called the scientific worldview. I believe I can safely say that this anthroposophically oriented worldview, which many people these days still consider to be a sect, as though it were nothing more than a quirk of a few unworldly people, wants to listen to and understand as deeply as possible what moves our time most deeply. It wants to grasp completely and deeply a moral issue that moves our time, and likely also the near future. Ladies and gentlemen, are we not right in saying that what is called the scientific worldview, which has developed over the course of the past three or four centuries, has called into question much of the old ways of thinking that used to satisfy people's hearts and minds? Indeed, much of what people held sacred through centuries, through millennia, had to be cast off. And science has shown much to be illusion that ancient views considered their most prized possessions. And are not the woes and catastrophes of our time telling us clearly that the time has come, that the moment in world history has now come, when this scientific worldview must fulfill what so many have long expected from it? Namely, it must again open a path for us to those spiritual heights without which we ultimately cannot live, and the old paths which science has taken from us. Ladies and gentlemen, the anthroposophical worldview wants to take this question very seriously. Now, I am under no illusions that in the short time of my lecture, I can convince anyone in this hall of what anthroposophy is actually striving for. I will not be able to do more than sketch out a few of the paths that are being followed in this area. I will be able to stimulate ideas and thoughts regarding the questions we need to ask, and the way we need to research and study in the area of this anthroposophically oriented worldview. In its essence, anthroposophy is indeed very different from all other contemporary sciences, and because, in its essence, anthroposophy is different in particular from what is usually considered the only valid scientific approach today, it is widely misunderstood, and is, we may indeed say so, treated badly. In the ordinary sciences, as in life in general, people believe that the only source of human knowledge is what they can perceive and experience through their senses, and what their reason and intellect, through observation, can draw from this sensory world, in terms of natural laws and the like. People try in this way to gain an overview of their environment, their world. In this way, people try to develop an understanding about their place and purpose in the world order. Basically, people consider how they, as human beings, are born into the world, how they are raised and educated, in the usual sense of the word, and how they can then, as a result of their ordinary education, and on the basis of this being born into the world, with their inherited abilities and characteristics, look at life scientifically or otherwise. However, This is not the standpoint of anthroposophy. Instead, anthroposophy appeals to something in human beings that today is still rare in human nature, and that will have to make itself felt in human culture in a very different way than it does today, if humanity is to fulfill its next cultural task. Anthroposophy appeals to what I want to call intellectual modesty or humility. I often use a comparison to explain what I mean by intellectual humility. And this comparison leads us right away into the core of what anthroposophy really wants to be. For example, if we hand a volume of Goethe's poems to a 5-year-old child, what will the child do with the volume of poetry? Well, at first the child will likely play with the book, and then eventually tear it up. In any case, this child will not have any idea of the actual purpose of the book of poems. If we teach that child, then by the time he or she is a young adult of perhaps 17, 18, or 19 years, this person now may make a very different use of that book of Goethe's poems. We can now say that the 5-year-old was looking at the very same thing as the now 17 or 18-year-old. But the latter responds very differently than the child, because something has been developed. Something has been drawn out of this person's inner depths that then leads to a very different relationship to the book of poetry than before. When we apply this to our relationship with nature, with the entire world, what follows is what I want to call intellectual humility, which is the decision to admit that no matter how old we get, how we are raised and educated in ordinary life, as human beings, we relate to nature and the world around us, like the 5-year-old child relates to the book of Goethe's poetry. In order to relate differently to the world and act differently, we first must draw up something that lies deep within our inner being, in our innermost being. Only then can something reveal itself to us that cannot be offered through ordinary sense observation or deductive reasoning, as is active in conventional life and development. It is the essence of the anthroposophical worldview that we do not approach the study of things just as we are. Rather, we must first draw out something that lies hidden within our inner being. Only after we have thus taken our own development in hand, in a sense, and have advanced beyond what we are as a result of being born, raised, and educated in this world in the ordinary way, that is, after we have made ourselves into a different person, only then can we approach the investigation and research of things. In other words, transforming our entire soul life first before studying and exploring things. This is the essence that underlies the striving and aspirations of the anthroposophically oriented worldview. And here I must tell you that the anthroposophically oriented worldview is based on two cornerstones, especially in its scientific life. One of these cornerstones consists of the boundaries of our knowledge of nature. In regard to the knowledge of nature, anthroposophy agrees fully with that conscientious research that sets definite limits or boundaries to the exploration of nature in the natural sciences. Indeed, in general, the anthroposophically oriented worldview is fully in agreement with all that natural science discovers in a legitimate way. By avoiding dilettantism and instead delving objectively and appropriately into any area of the natural sciences, we inevitably come up against boundaries. And we must place certain concepts at these boundaries. And today, just as an example, I want to mention two of the many we could name, namely the concepts of the atom, or matter, and that of force. In the natural sciences, we then work with concepts such as force and matter. and much philosophical thinking has been concerned with concepts such as force and matter. Today, this has gone so far that it was attempted to establish a philosophy of the, in quotes, as if. That is, according to that philosophy, we cannot arrive at any clear, enlightening concepts of force and matter, and therefore we should continue our research in the wider field of phenomena, of perceptions, in quotes, as if such concepts corresponded to something real, which we simply do not know. That is, as if those concepts had any kind of legitimacy at all. You will surely agree that this philosophy of the as-if is a desperate worldview, even though it seems plausible to many people in our time. As we face this concept, this boundary concept of the knowledge of nature, we are standing at a cornerstone of human knowledge. Examined merely intellectually, these concepts become the bane of our existence, where human knowing and perception are concerned. Anthroposophists now try to deal with this concept in a way that is very different from that of ordinary philosophers. Ordinary philosophy continues to apply the intellectual method even at those points where we have reached the boundaries of the natural sciences. Spiritual science, as I mean it, begins with something completely different in the human soul. When we have reached this boundary concept, one part of the methods of spiritual science, spiritual research, becomes obvious. This part consists in a form of meditation that is not in any way confused or shoddily mystical. Rather, the meditation I mean here is systematic, well organized, and practiced rigorously and conscientiously. This meditation is what I want to describe first of all, at least in principle. You can find the details in my books, especially entitled Knowledge of the Higher Worlds. What matters here is that we repeatedly, and I want to underscore emphatically that patience and energy are essential for these things, that we repeatedly practice again and again. You may think that doing research in a chemistry lab or in an observatory is difficult, and that it is easy to achieve something through a systematic transformation of your soul. But if you keep strictly to the rigorous method in this area, you will see that doing research in labs, clinics, or observatories is relatively easy compared to those processes that most people imagine to be easier than they are, and that essentially amount to a transformation of the soul life. At the start of this process, we place at the center of our imagination clearly defined simple concepts. Let's say, initially concepts we ourselves have formed, or symbols, or the like. What matters here, ladies and gentlemen, is not that these concepts and mental pictures correspond to a truth. What matters is what is affected, brought about in our soul, through these mental pictures. What matters is that with these mental pictures, we implement strict self-education, rigorous self-discipline in our intellect. Therefore, we place at the center of our soul life concepts or mental pictures that we can keep strictly in view, either concepts we ourselves have formed or ones that experienced spiritual researchers have recommended to us. First of all, we try to eliminate everything else from our consciousness and concentrate our consciousness only and exclusively on such strictly understood concepts. As soon as we concentrate on such concepts and mental pictures, our physical thoughts and memories come swarming toward us from all sides, like bees swarming to the hive. And these thoughts actually want to foil our inner method. We must therefore exert more and more effort to maintain our focus. And this exertion of force, this effort, is the important thing. What matters is that we drive the will with all our might ever deeper into the life of our imagination, into our mental pictures, so that we actually become stronger as we exert this effort of driving the will into the life of the imagination. That is one aspect of strictly scientific meditation, or rather of meditation that leads to science, that we drive the will into the life of our imagination. Such exercises cannot be completed in a matter of a few days. They require many years of effort, and we must return to them and repeat them again and again. It is not a matter of doing these exercises for a long time on any given day. Indeed, a few minutes a day is all that's needed. What matters is that we return to the effort and repeat it again and again. Then we will finally experience that the soul is drawing up from its deepest depths forces that are quite different from what we call on in ordinary life and even in ordinary science. Applying these forces, then, by focusing all effort of will on a content we ourselves have chosen, will, after some time, as I said, I can only outline the principle here, you can read about the details in my books, we will then have the possibility to approach the boundary concepts of the natural sciences, including such concepts as matter and force and the like, I could mention many others, in a way that is not just purely intellectual. Then comes the following. We no longer speculate or philosophize about these boundaries of our knowledge of nature. Rather, we come to experience something in these concepts. In the encounter with these concepts, something happens in our soul that includes experiences we otherwise only have when we experience love in the external world, for example, or when we are otherwise embroiled in the struggle of our outer life. In other words, the main point here is that we disregard the outside world and inwardly undergo something that leads us into a reality that is just as intense for us, is experienced just as intensely by our consciousness, as is otherwise the case only with external reality, which we rightfully touch and process with our hands and feet. When we have, through concentration and meditation, worked our way to a consciousness that has become stronger inwardly in the intellect through our effort of will, then at last something makes its appearance that we can describe as follows. Just as we usually see and recognize red in our ordinary outer sensory observation as a color, and likewise for blue, and just as we hear the note C sharp or C, so, we can then, with this newly developed capability, recognize and know directly in our consciousness that there is a soul as such. This is possible only when we have learned in the process described above to no longer rely on the body or the nervous system or the like as instruments for perception. Instead, we perceive the soul by experiencing it. Ladies and gentlemen, at the moment when all this happens through direct experience, we realize the following, and I want to indicate this by means of a comparison. Let's say we're walking along a dirt road made soft by rain. We see the ruts that carts have made in the road and the imprints of people's footsteps. As reasonable people, it would not occur to us to claim that these ruts in the softened road have been caused by forces that are down there underground, and that bring the soil into such a configuration that those ruts and footprints arise. Instead, as rational people, we will explain the ruts differently. We will say that something impacts the surface of the earth there, something that is a matter of complete indifference to that surface as such. So, something comes from outside and impacts the ground. Carts and people have passed along that road, and the force that is actively at work in shaping the earth is indifferent to all those passers-by. When we come to really know the inner configuration of the life of the soul in the way I have described, then we can finally see everything about the physical organization of the brain in such a way as to realize that this has definitely not somehow been shaped through inner forces of the person's physical configuration. Instead, the soul, which we have just come to know, has worked on this from the outside. Just as human footsteps or the wheels of a cart have worked on and shaped the sodden soil of the road. In other words, we do not come to know the soul through speculation, but only by gradually working our way up to experiencing it. That means that we must take as our starting point what in ordinary life and conventional science is considered the end point or destination, namely the intellectual realm, the concepts of perception. Once we have experienced the soul element in this way, in direct perception, then our method, the anthroposophical method, has brought us face to face with the experiential comprehension of what I want to call human pre-existence, the soul's spiritual pre-existence of the human being. That is, we need no longer make do with speculations about human immortality, because with this immediate perception, we then achieve a direct perception of pre-existence. We can then see inwardly in our soul, in direct spirit vision, what is working on the body and configuring it. As we look at what is working on the body, and as we observe it, we know how to trace it to the time before birth, or let's say the time before conception. Thus, anthroposophy, by its nature, studies the idea of immortality quite differently from the way conventional philosophy does. Conventional philosophy tries to deduce from what happens between birth and death something about what is beyond birth and death. In contrast, anthroposophy tries to see even the work of such deducing as only a preparation. It seeks to live into the development of boundary concepts so that it might experience what figures, what is active as the immortal element in the human being. Subjectively, what is filling human consciousness becomes more active than usual. And that is actually what is really important. I will have to tell you about this in more detail in a later part of my lecture. Namely, that in applying anthroposophy's methodology, we become ever more active. Indeed, as a result, we stop giving ourselves over passively to the course of events, at least to what we have created in the course of modern times through our setting up of experiments. And we stop giving in passively to what the experiments tell us. All of this has its legitimate place, and spiritual science certainly does not want to fight against this, but the anthroposophically oriented methodology advances to active thinking, a thinking that in the act of thinking grasps the immortal nature of the human being himself or herself. I know that much may be objected against this type of experience that must replace our ordinary discursive evidentiary substantiation to the extent that this can be justified philosophically. I will return to this point later, but for now I just wanted to show you, on the one hand, how in fact this part of the anthroposophical methodology, a part that is based on a valuation of thinking, on a working of the will into the intellect, leads to an essential recognition of human preexistence. In other words, we begin to comprehend the immortal element that is present before conception, before birth, in spiritual worlds. This may not be explained based on the physical body, because this immortal element is what works on the body, and because the body, our physical being, reveals itself, as I will show shortly with an example, as that which is shaped out of the spirit. The second important part of the anthroposophical methodology consists in the fact that we can approach our own self in a different way than is usually the case. Normally, people approach their own self through what is typically called mysticism in the usual sense of the word. Now, anthroposophists must no longer be under any illusions regarding the boundaries of what we can know about the world. Through the experience I have described, they must recognize this knowledge in its true form. And likewise, those who really want to be true researchers of anthroposophy must not be under the illusions offered by the deceptions and delusions of conventional mysticism. People who believe that they can look into the innermost part of the human being by following the path described by mystics throughout history, and as religion also often suggests, are not actually advancing to a true knowledge of the human self. Ladies and gentlemen, by following those paths, you cannot get beyond that element of deception. After all, how much do we really know of what we have heard here or there, for example, in childhood? Let's say in childhood you were lying on a meadow somewhere and heard bells ringing in the distance. This perception barely entered your awareness, and you probably forgot it right away. Decades later, as an adult, you may encounter some event or experience in the world in which there is a faint echo reminiscent of that sound of bells from long ago, a sound barely even noticed back then. Actually, a great number of ideas, of which we believe that they come forth out of our inner being, are likewise really nothing more than reminiscences of what we have experienced in our early youth. Those who truly make an effort in a more rigorous psychology than is commonly practiced today to study the inner life of the human being in this way know how much human self-knowledge is prone to deception. They know that what the mystics throughout history believed they were drawing up out of their inner life as a force of some kind is really nothing more than the transformed experiences of a younger age that have, perhaps, become nebulous by now, but are in any case metamorphosed. In order to approach the boundaries of what we can know about the world without any deception, we must undergo the process I have outlined here, and we must take care not to fall prey to some nebulous mysticism in the usual sense. Instead, we must systematically train our soul in a different way at the other cornerstone of human knowledge. And we can only do this if we draw near to something we usually do not pay much attention to in our ordinary life. We experience our life between birth and death from decade to decade, from year to year. We give ourselves over passively to much in this life. Only a few things do we approach actively, entering into them intentionally with our will. If you want to become a spiritual researcher in the sense described here, you have to consider what I want to call strict and systematic self-discipline as the second part of the path of knowledge. You have to commit to it repeatedly, and that is why this path to knowledge takes years, many years. You have to resolve again and again and commit to the following. You want to incorporate or embody, as Nietzsche called it, this or that character trait into yourself. You want to make this or that out of yourself. If you then become able to bridge, so to speak, between the now and a point in time that lies perhaps 5, 10, or 15 years in the past, and you have in the course of those years incorporated something into your soul through your own activity, then you can also investigate how what you have incorporated over the course of 5, 10, or 15 years, something you made your own through self-discipline, works. That is, you can perceive then how this element has now become something different, how it appears as a new element in you. Ladies and gentlemen, if you then manage in this way to carry into your intellect, your concepts, your imagination, what otherwise works only as will, that is, when you have introduced your will into your intellect, then you must bring this intellect into your life, into that willing that usually just flows past you as you passively submit yourself to life. Instead, it is now necessary to take life into your own hands. What this means is that, in a sense, you accompany yourself, walking alongside yourself and observing yourself. And you must do this with the necessary naivete, so as not to lose your naivete toward life. Through such processes, then, we become our own doppelganger, in a sense. At the same time, we become able to make the life of our will into something we can observe the way we usually observe only the outer world around us. If we achieve this, and in a way double ourselves, to become both spectator and agent in our life, then we have achieved something that manifests in a very particular way. For what we have so far essentially considered only our memory will become clear to us in a new way. The memory pictures now carry what we have experienced 10, 15, or 20 years ago into the present. Now we experience something entirely new that appears much like a transformation or metamorphosis of memory. To make sure I will not be misunderstood, I want to point out emphatically that, of course, in our ordinary life, we retain our usual memory. It is only when we are engaged in spiritual research that we experience the transformation of memory, which I still have to describe. In particular, we then experience something we otherwise only experience in the three-dimensional space around us. In space, we can walk, for example, through an alley, and when we look back behind us, we see not only images of the trees we have walked by, but we also see, albeit in a different perspective than before, the trees themselves. This is how the new experience appears in our consciousness. We look back on our life, but see not only the images and fantasies we had in the past, but we also recognize, just as when we look around us in an alley, from this other perspective, that we can survey our life in the immediate present as though time had become space. What is usually memory becomes an entirely new spiritual force, a new way of looking into time. And only at that moment do we attain true knowledge of that mysterious element in our own being, an element that is otherwise as unknown to us as the content of dreamless sleep is unknown to our ordinary consciousness. This is how we gain insight into the nature of the human will. And we can indeed then see this essence of the human will as it works in the physical body. By coming to know the will as transformed memory, we achieve immediate direct perception regarding the other end of life, namely post-existence. We can learn about what carries us beyond the portal of death and into a spiritual world. Again, it is by training a very specific element of the soul to be capable of a direct experience that anthroposophically oriented spiritual science wants to advance to a comprehensive worldview. Ladies and gentlemen, by addressing the two cornerstones of human knowledge in this way, namely knowledge of the world on the one hand, and knowledge of ourself on the other, we reach, on the one hand, beyond the limits of what we can know about the world, not through speculation, but through immediate experience, and enter into the soul life as such. And, on the other hand, we advance into the element of our own will, not through engaging in mysticism, but by cultivating the memory capacity in us through strict self-discipline. As a result, we actually awaken what is immortal within us. And that seems to me to be a continuation, not of the external scientific method of the present time, but of scientific education. I may as well admit that it seems to me that those who do not stop short at what the natural sciences, those laudable sciences, offer us in the present time, because they have a blind faith in authority or are just plain complacent or lazy, will take on the big question that the natural sciences lay upon our soul. They will feel compelled, as I have described it in my book, titled The Riddles of Philosophy, to get beyond what the natural sciences can give us, not by speculating and philosophizing, but by seeking to further develop what they apply in experimentation, so as to attain a more active intellect and a more active will. They will then achieve the intensity of soul life I have just spoken of, so that immortality is not something conjectured, but something directly perceived. And then, ladies and gentlemen, something else will make its appearance as a matter of course. Something that, when it is described as it is, for example, in my book titled An Outline of Esoteric Science, as well as in many of my other books, people today still consider the product of a wild imagination. Something that I am nevertheless convinced will gradually and increasingly emerge precisely out of the mystery of natural science itself. How do we find our way, then, in natural science? We apply rigorous methods, and particularly those who are basing themselves on anthroposophy will be among the last to flout those strict scientific methods. But you see, we are then confronted with the following. For example, we may develop certain views on geology, and we try, based on Lyell and other geologists as our starting point, to attain a picture of the geological layers of the earth at the present time. We try, then, with the all too familiar methods, to gain from this picture a view of the past. The historical and geological epochs are still controversial, by going back millions of years. Other researchers go millions of years into the future by prophetically predicting this or that end of the world based on physical or geological facts. That is, we work out a picture of how our Earth developed and how humanity has developed with it. Now, keep in mind that in the short time of a lecture, I cannot give you a complete insight into the already existing research results of spiritual science. But when you read the relevant literature, you will see that certain things are there. Now, I can only indicate and roughly sketch how these things are researched. For example, let's take studies of the human heart. We get a picture of how the heart changes over the period of 5 or 10 or more years. From this, we then deduce what the human heart was like 30 years ago, let's say. Of course, we easily do this for people who are now in their 40s, but not for people who are now only in their 20s. But we could also continue the pure deduction and, still following the rigorous scientific method, could similarly ask what this heart was like 30 years ago. In doing so, we would not follow any other method than the one also applied today by geologists, when they tell us what this or that geological layer was like millions of years ago. With this, we have forgotten that all those millions of years ago, the earth perhaps did not yet exist, just as human beings did not yet exist at that time as physical human beings. And using the laws of physics or geology to pronounce some prophecies about how the world will end millions of years hence is no different from taking the change we see in the human heart over a period of 5 years as our starting point for calculating what this human heart was like 300 years ago. At first this seems like a great paradox, and yet, ladies and gentlemen, this is all entirely justified for those who delve into the laudable natural sciences of our time, not with their intellect or out of unquestioning acceptance of authority, but with their whole soul and an unbiased human nature. Moreover, an approach such as I have outlined here can be very useful for the sciences of our time, for it is unfortunately still the case today that one has only a few colleagues working alongside in any field of spiritual science. The colleagues one would wish for are definitely not the laypeople or dilettantes. The matter is much too serious for that. Instead, the colleagues I would most wish for are people who have learned to work scientifically and have worked for years loyally and with dedication, to really immerse themselves in a scientific field, and who have retained their impartiality and openness in all their scientific work. That impartiality or unself-consciousness is essential to be able to transform the cognitive and soul forces in the way I have indicated. Only then is it possible to arrive in a more concrete and truly realistic way at knowledge of human nature, for example. Anthroposophy will be the best foundation for an anthropology that can be useful for medicine and the social sciences. That is why it gave me such satisfaction to be able, several weeks ago, to hold a week-long lecture course in Dornach, where we built the Goetheanum and established the anthroposophically oriented school for spiritual science. The course was attended by 40 doctors and medical students. I mention this course because it fits in with what we are talking about here. Its topic was how to build a bridge between pathology and therapy, a bridge so many long for, particularly also those in the medical professions. In that course, I talked about how this bridge can be built based on the kind of insight into the human being that can be attained when we no longer think only abstractly about the relationships between body and soul, but become able to perceive them concretely. I want to give you a little example. It will be somewhat remote, but it will also point to the concreteness with which spiritual science wants to address the specifically scientific human problems. It is certainly the case that many people speculate a great deal about the relationship between body and soul, and they have come up with theories of parallelism, theories of interaction, and so on. Still, what we are dealing with there is not a true perception of the soul spiritual, on the one hand, which one reaches only in the way I have described today, and the physical body, on the other hand. The materialistically oriented worldview suffers from the tragic fate of not having mastered matter. Since the advent of materialism, we have not been able to look inside the material processes, because the inner part of the material processes is something spiritual. And so we must first understand and perceive the spirit in order to understand the material processes. Thus, I want to show you more as a sort of result what we arrive at regarding knowledge of a moment in human development when we approach it in accordance with spiritual science. We see how human beings grow into physical life through birth. We see then how there is a certain closure of something when children at the age of 6, 7, 8 or thereabouts have their secondary dentition. This secondary dentition, the growth of the adult teeth, is understood in the right way only when we take the entire human body, spirit, soul, being into consideration. That is, when we consider how that entire being changes in this important period of life. I can only hint at this here, but when we look at the soul element, we see, first of all, what I have often explained here in lectures, given more for lay people. That is, we see how the child previously, before the loss of the baby teeth, developed by imitating, and now with the growth of the adult teeth, becomes someone who wants to develop under the influence of authority. That is, with the change in dentition, there is a change from the principle of imitation to that of authority. But aside from that, when we are able to really look at this human soul life, when we have learned to deepen our observation of this soul life and really learn how to deepen ourselves, when we develop within us everything I have described today as discipline of the will and the intellect, when we then look at everything that is happening with the person around the time of the secondary dentition, we will notice how what initially develops as a capacity for memory in the human being undergoes a specific change with the advent of the permanent dentition. It is striking how, beginning in this period of life, our imagination starts to have contours, starts to develop into successive mental pictures that we can remember. And I could point out many other things in this connection. But in that case, I would have to talk for a long time if I wanted to show you how the transformation of the entire intellectual soul element manifests itself purely empirically around the time when the permanent teeth are coming in. We can then go on to investigate further what can be studied in this area. And we must do so with the concrete empiricism that arises from the fact that we have sharpened the eyes of our soul through the methods I've described here. In that process, we will find that, in a sense, this process of the permanent teeth being pushed out reveals something that works within the child in the first 7 years of life, then pushes itself out and reaches its peak, culminates with the change in dentition. That is, at the time when the permanent teeth come in, the soul changes. Concepts gain contours. Our memory, which naturally already existed before this time, now changes. When we then apply the concepts of Goethe's theory of metamorphosis to these developments, we see that the soul, spiritual life, has emancipated itself from the physical body. We also see that what will later work in the imagination and in the intellect already worked in the body earlier, shaping and forming it, and reached its culmination at the time of the permanent dentition. Once the permanent teeth have come in, that same force manifests itself in the spiritual soul life. That is, we can follow this development concretely, no longer in abstractions, and not as speculation used otherwise about body and soul. We can see directly this shaping force at work. We can see it later when the person calls forth from memory those sharply contoured concepts and not figments of the imagination. There we can see how that force shapes the body and how it drives the forces into the change in dentition. By extending our observation through time, we can see how the spiritual soul element is working in the physical body. Now, when we observe human beings in the stage of life where they reach sexual maturity, we see that during the period between the appearance of the permanent teeth and puberty, it is above all the element of will that consolidates itself. There is still something active in the body, the effect of which we can notice in what manifests outwardly. In boys it will be evident in the voice change, and in girls it will manifest differently, but no less so. What is active there is the will. The will takes hold of the organism in the period between the beginning of secondary dentition and puberty. While the intellect emancipates itself, and with the permanent dentition, is in a way set free and becomes autonomous, the will is liberated in the period leading up to puberty. I would like to put it like this. Something purely spiritual connects itself with the body, and in the change that happens in boys with the change of the voice, we can see clearly how the life of the will manifests itself as a formative force in the body. From just these two elements I have given here, you can see how we concretely observe the human being based on spiritual empiricism. What I have shown you there then leads us beyond the human being and out into the cosmos, and we come to know it just as we come to know the content of the sensory world through the senses. Through this direct spiritual perception, we come to know a deeper and also more essential element of the cosmos. For example, we see that the human being is embedded in cosmic forces, and we come to know what, in these forces, is at work in the human being, on the one hand, in the early years up to the secondary dentition, and on the other hand, in the years until puberty. That force initially works as an intellectual one, shaping us until the secondary dentition. Then it emancipates itself and works on the other side as a will element that intensively takes hold of the human body at the time of puberty. Now we realize that that which pushes the adult teeth out and thus works in our organism, moving on into the sharply contoured concepts of memory, is what we could call, but only figuratively, light. Actually, however, it is everything that relates to our sensory perception in the way light relates to the eyes. We come to know that it is actually light that works in the human organism, and that through the force of light, which is active in the eye's faculty of sight, we overcome what is otherwise experienced only as heaviness, as gravitational pull. Of course, this all applies only figuratively. We could find the same element for all the other senses too. Light and heaviness, light and gravity, are engaged in a battle. Cosmic light and cosmic gravity are at work in the human body until the secondary dentition. And then, from the time of the permanent dentition to puberty, gravity gains the upper hand. And that which is light-filled, which here again is only figurative, is the content of our sensory perceptions. But gravity achieves a victory, an inner victory, over this light-like element. And in this way it forces the will into human nature, and thus configures human beings inwardly with what then makes them sexually mature. Gravity leads the human organization toward its center of gravity. Ladies and gentlemen, this learning to see and gain insight into human nature, this immediate, concrete, and empirical connecting of the spiritual with matter, that is what the anthroposophically oriented worldview offers. Truly, this is not a matter of some nebulous mysticism, but a matter of methodical study that is not only just as rigorous as what is customary in the sciences, but is indeed even more rigorous, because every individual phenomenon we approach in this way is also, at the same time, accompanied by what the soul has made of itself in order to become able to see something new in the old. What we see in human beings in the anthropocentric view is extended to encompass the entire cosmos without falling into anthropomorphism. And you will realize that we are dealing here with a rigorous scientific method when we have developed ourselves in the way I have outlined in my book title, An Outline of Esoteric Science. Ladies and gentlemen, some people, of course, find it easy to laugh at such a book. They do not see or understand all the effort, all the paths pursued, and all the studies that went into writing such a work. But such things have to be said in our time. The materialistic orientation has brought us precisely to the point of no longer being able to know matter. Instead, we can engage only in speculations about the relationship between spirit or soul and body or matter. But anthroposophically oriented spiritual science is intended to teach us to really know the human being, to truly comprehend ourselves as we are as spirit, soul, and body, and from this to open the paths to knowing the cosmos, for the human being comprises everything that is also in the cosmos. For example, we can call forth, conjure up, as image within us, something that is long past, something we have experienced, and that we still carry within us as an image, even though the event is long over. Because I was once present in that experience with my senses, my reason, and my soul and feeling, that is why I can conjure it up again. As human beings, we were present in everything that has ever happened in the cosmos. And for that reason, once we grasp our full being, we can comprehend what is really cosmic. And we can do so in a different way than if we had to struggle for that comprehension outwardly. As I have described earlier, inner knowledge also provides a certain cosmology, so that anthroposophy expands into a true cosmology, as I've tried to explain in my book titled An Outline of Esoteric Science. This book may still seem laughable to many of our contemporaries, but it is based on a rigorous scientific method, one that originated, however, out of the essence of the anthroposophical orientation. What I have described here as the essence of anthroposophy can in a certain sense also be justified in philosophical terms. And those who have been reading my writings from the beginning will know this. I tried in the 1880s, commenting on Goethe's writings, to develop an epistemology, and I tried in my little book, titled Truth and Knowledge, to show the relationship between human inner life and what is out there in the cosmos. Then I tried in my book, titled The Philosophy of Freedom, to apply this to the entire worldview of the human being. Those who have read all of this will find that great effort was expended to justify, in philosophical terms, as far as is possible today, what is appearing now in higher spiritual empiricism, as spiritual science, as anthroposophy. And I must say that for decades I have had to fight a hard struggle against Kantianism. That is, it's been a tough struggle against Kantianism, which has misjudged the epistemological problem, and thus, what I am convinced, is the fundamental problem of philosophy. In the few minutes I still have this evening, I cannot go into detail regarding Kantian philosophy or epistemology, but with just a few words, I can indicate what is actually at stake here, philosophically speaking, if we really want to fully understand the human being. We can begin by looking empirically at how human beings come to the boundary of what can be known about nature and the world. That is, we come to a cornerstone at this boundary of knowledge of nature, in such concepts as matter, energy, and so on, when this knowledge is not yet extended anthroposophically. True, what matters here is that those who are able to experientially examine that boundary of knowledge of nature now understand why human beings are organized in such a way that at a certain point they must set up concepts that are, so to speak, dark and opaque for ordinary human consciousness. And, ladies and gentlemen, I ask you to please forgive my use of the word why in this connection. It is meant really only rhetorically, not teleologically. After all, if we could always look into things around us, and in a sense make them transparent to us intellectually, and do the same where human beings are concerned, we would not be able to develop in our human nature something we need for our ordinary life, especially also for our ordinary social life, and must therefore absolutely develop in the time between birth and death. That is, we would otherwise not have what lives within us as the element of love. Those who have thoroughly studied the psychology of the connection between knowledge and love will notice that this separation from the things that have become intellectually opaque for us, that manifest for us in the boundaries of knowledge about nature, is necessary. This separation is necessary so that we in our entire human organization can develop the power of love. Not what Kant has brought up in his titled Critique of Pure Reason and the like, but what we develop within us as the power of love is what keeps us from making things intellectually transparent to ourselves. We arrive at this intellectual transparency only on the paths I have described today. We human beings are organized in such a way that we have to purchase the power of love for ourselves at the price of the limits of what we can know about the world. But as human beings, we are also those beings who, through the power of their love, receive their true value and their human dignity between birth and death. And again, on the other hand, we have the other cornerstone, the one that many people want to overcome so blithely by means of a nebulous mysticism. But it can be overcome only through that methodical self-discipline that I have described today. That is the cornerstone of self-knowledge. Indeed, if we were always able to look within ourselves, if we could attain the kind of knowledge that, in a way, turns time into space, that, in an altered time perspective, makes earlier events supersensibly perceptible in spiritual vision, that, in a sense, tears away the veil of memories and lets us look into the past, and thus also, in a sense, into the future, if we were always able to do this, then we would certainly see all of this, but we would not have the power of memory, the faculty of recall. This power of memory is what we also need to have, just as in ordinary human life, we need to have love. Those who know what it means to have a disturbed faculty of memory, and how that affects the continuity of the I, capital, who know that this I is based on the power of undisturbed memory, those are the people who will also be able to appreciate that this other cornerstone must be there. The force that makes us into a person capable of memory in the period between birth and death, only this is what enables us to tear away this veil of memories in accordance with the method of anthroposophical spiritual science, and to look in self-knowledge into our own inner life. Those who understand this organization, who with true psychology compare what appears in memory with what self-knowledge is, they will know that we also must have this other cornerstone in our ordinary human life and ordinary knowledge. Accordingly, it is due to our organization that we must grow beyond what organizes us in ordinary life, in a way somewhat differently from how Kant described it. And only by means of growing beyond that will we be able to penetrate into the depths of nature that we aspire to and long to know. Ladies and gentlemen, this anthroposophically oriented spiritual science, once it undertakes this path in inner aliveness, finds what today is still very daring to say. But is it good to leave such things unspoken when they are what really matters? When today you look at how we have to conceive of the world based on the thoughts and ideas that have emerged in the past 3 or 4 centuries, you cannot establish the bridge between what arises in the soul as an ethical, moral, or social ideal, or even as a religious ideal, on the one hand, and what follows from the results of knowledge of nature, on the other hand. On the one side, we see the natural phenomena. They lead us, even if only hypothetically, or in the philosophy of, in quotes, as if, to a beginning, to an earlier condition of the physical universe. They lead us then to metamorphoses of this physical universe, and they show us how a law prevails in this physical universe, or let's say 2 laws, that are, however, actually only one. When these laws prevail the way current knowledge of nature conceives of them, then no bridge can be built to the other side, to the ethical, social, or religious ideal. And these 2 laws are the law of the conservation of mass and the law of the conservation of energy. If the world out there in the universe, in nature, changes in such a way that matter is indestructible and energy in its eternal conservation is only altered, then our ethical ideals, our religious ideals, are nothing more than a plume of smoke. Then they are our grand illusions. And when the world has long since transformed its matter and its energies in a certain way, the world experiences that are comprised in our moral, religious ideals, and so on, will be carried to their grave, sunk into oblivion. Usually, people do not point this out. But what inwardly splits so many souls in our time, what tears apart many souls in our time, is what arises more or less unconsciously as a mood of soul out of this total failure to build a bridge between the knowledge of nature and the spiritual understanding of ethics and religion. However, my dear ladies and gentlemen, when we experience our intellectual capacity at the boundaries of what we can know about nature in the way I have described to you today, then we realize that our intellect really belongs only to a certain part of our outer existence. We should not think of the beginning of our existence on earth with our intellect, which we only really get to know in the experiences described. For this intellect belongs to what follows after that beginning and comes before the ending. When we apply this intellect to the entire course of events and use it to look forward or backward for millions of years, the way geologists and physicists do, then we are essentially doing the same thing as when we talk thoughtlessly, for example, of the metamorphosis of the heart taking place in a human being 300 years ago or 300 years hence. We must be clear about the nature of the intellect. It does not reach as far as the other powers of knowing that we have to attain in the way and by the methods I describe today. With anthroposophically oriented spiritual science, we are not establishing a value theory along the lines of the ones propounded by Rickert or Windelband, and according to which values arise out of sheer invention, without reality. Instead, we are concerned here with what we can survey and grasp with our intellect. We feel obligated to integrate value in some way into the streams of being. This, however, will be entirely impossible, as long as we do not overcome the deadening law of the conservation of matter and energy. We must come to think of matter and energy as transitory. It is only a world of illusion that has revealed itself out of our intellect and leads us wrongly to believe that matter is indestructible and that energy is conserved. It is obvious that the science of the 19th century could not lead to anything else but this. But if you can understand the world in the way I have presented today, then you will see that what we call matter and energy perish just as the plants of this year perish. And then what lives in you as ethical or religious ideal is something that you experience as seed, much like the seed and the blossom of the current plants. We look at this plant seed, which at this time may be no bigger than a tiny dot, and we know that it will be a plant next year, when the blossom and leaves around it that we see now will long since have disappeared. In spiritual perception, we look at this outer world to which we usually apply our intellect. And in this process, we come to know this world not based on the principle of the conservation of matter and energy, but as a world that dissolves. And we realize that the seeds in it are what rule in the human soul as moral or religious ideas. What our senses perceive around us now, it will be gone. What grows and thrives in our inner life is what will become the world of the future, the cosmos of the future. I am convinced that the bridge to be established between spirit and nature can, given the world as it is today, only be found through anthroposophically oriented spiritual science. My dear ladies and gentlemen, thanks to an invitation from the Free Student Association, I have been allowed to say these few sentences that I hope you found inspiring. I know that they cannot serve as evidence or proof or be convincing. But after all, they don't aim to do more than just indicate and inspire. But because I had the opportunity today, an opportunity for which I am very grateful, to speak at the behest of the Student Association, I want particularly to point out that especially for someone who, like me, must see the world in this way and who is himself at the end of his sixth decade, it is especially a matter close to my heart to look at today's young generation. And so I can indeed see in the heart and soul of those who are young real seeds, because I can look back at my own youth. And here I want to say to the young friends who have invited me today, that four decades ago, people who are now my age were young. Back then we looked out into the world, but we could not help but look, in a certain sense, into a world of illusions. Back then we were dependent on this. There were many mighty achievements of outer life in the offing for people back then, but the civilized Europe of that time looked very different from today. A brilliant man, namely Oswald Spengler, writes today about the fall of Western civilization. Back then, that is, about 30 or 40 years ago, we lived in an era that was perhaps more than any other governed by the motto, quote, "We've come such a long way," close quote. We talked about how marvelously far we had come in a grand way. That was a time that deeply cherished its illusions. How strong those illusions were, how deeply they ran, became clear to some who were young back then only in 1914, when this modern civilization rolled into an awful catastrophe. Then an infinite pain descended on the souls of many thoughtful, awakened, older people. And they probably looked back to those days when they were not permitted to say, because the prevailing illusions were too great, "We need something that is not only a renaissance, but also a naissance, not only a resurgence, but also an emergence, the birth of a new spiritual life." Now that those painful years are behind us, ladies and gentlemen, the youth, I believe, live differently than was the case formerly. Now there is great need, and in all areas it is evident that we cannot give ourselves over to the illusion, namely the illusion that we've come such a wonderfully long way. No, I believe in those who are awake or can wake themselves up. There lives something of what leads them to the exhortation, "Use your will." In the outer objective world, everything argues for decline and downfall. But those like Spengler, who speak only about downfall, and even want to prove this downfall, will turn out to be wrong when the fire in the soul of the young generation makes itself felt. I mean the fire or power in the young people that wants to awaken the soul to action, to willing. Because it is only out of the action and willing of people who are conscious of themselves that any improvement can come. Improvement comes only from that, not from speculating about forces we are supposed to believe in. No, it's only through activating powers within us that we can make a difference, powers that lie in our own will, in our own capacities. That is why I want to conclude this talk, for which I am grateful to have been invited by the esteemed Student Association, with the following words of Fichte, quote, "A man can do what he ought to do, and when he says he cannot, it is because he does not want to." Close quote. When we become aware of the spirit that we see in our spiritual perception shining toward us out of the universe and that fights within us in a struggle with gravity, then this spirit will motivate us to become active, and then there will come from our young generation what all people who are awake must now be hoping and longing for. Indeed, we do not just need a renaissance. We need a new birth of the spirit. We will have this when the young generation of today understands and honors its task. The end of Lecture 3.